SohaibWeb.com presents an exclusive interview with Dalia Mujahid, who is a senior analyst and executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Dalia. My name is Anna Majid. I write for Imam Sohaib Webb's blog, and I really want to thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to start by asking you a few questions about your background and that kind of thing, and where were you raised and where you went to school?
Okay, great.
Okay. Were you born in the United States or were you born in Egypt?
I was born in Egypt, and I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, where I attended public school and went to the University of Wisconsin for my education. I studied chemical engineering and then joined Procter & Gamble as a products researcher, then moved on to get my MBA and then joined Gallup. All during that time, though, I was studying STEM and Islamic sciences. And I was also, I also started a cross-cultural consulting and education organization in Pittsburgh, where I would conduct talks and workshops for law enforcement, educators, and the general public.
And when you were sort of in high school and just growing up, was this something you always wanted to do or you saw yourself doing, or did you just kind of find it along throughout your education?
It was definitely not something I ever thought I would be doing. What I had in mind always was to do something that was meaningful and that had mission. And so I didn't really know what that was going to be, but I always had my compass targeted toward something that would make a difference and that would help.
Make it like a contribution to the Islamically.
A contribution, exactly, to the world and to what, you know, to try to make people's lives better in some way.
It's certainly a very unique thing. You don't really see many Muslim people, let alone women, tackling kind of arena statistics and, like, you know, chemical engineering and sort of getting very involved. So what do you think, like, if you could talk to a teenage Muslim girl right now, would she sort of possess that inclination? Would you have any advice to give her?
Well, I guess I would say that everything is really open to her, that every profession, especially in technical fields like survey research and other sciences, are open to her, and that she shouldn't let anything limit what she might want to go into. And I also encourage her to really follow what she feels she has a special talent in, and then that talent is really a gift from God, and she has a responsibility, just like we all do, to show gratitude for that talent by utilizing it for good.
That's very true, and inshallah, I hope that Muslims, we can sort of create cultural arenas or, you know, institutions where people can feel more comfortable with that. But moving on to Who Speaks for Islam project, why did you pick that particular name?
Well, the name really came from the idea that when we look around and see who is speaking for Muslims, we find that a vocal and often violent fringe group has really monopolized the conversation on Muslims and who they are. And in many cases, this vocal fringe is very polarizing in their representation. They're either saying that the West is the enemy of Islam, or they're saying Islam is the enemy of the West. But when we take a much more scientific look at this issue, and we give a voice to what we're calling the silenced majority, the vast majority of people who have been silenced, who don't have access to the airwaves, who aren't speaking as loud as the extremists. When we hear their voice, we find a very, very different picture. And so the question is really a rhetorical question around who gets to speak for Islam and who should be representing
right.
Muslims. Is it a tiny fringe that has access to the airwaves, or should it be a much more representative and accurate view of what Muslims really think?
Mm-hmm. And I felt just the whole nature of your project and the way it was some sort of a systematic census, it takes a sensational sort of thing away from it, where you don't have a number of people saying extreme things. You have a number of quote-unquote average people just expressing their views on things. And so how did this come about, and how long would it have taken you to conduct such a huge project?
I guess I would say it really even started, I mean, just this idea started 70 years ago with the beginning of Gallup. And the whole mission of the company, Dr. George Gallup, the founder of the company, his entire mission was to harness this natural resource he called the wisdom of the people. And he said that leaders made better decisions when those decisions were informed by the will of the people. And so he created this tool, this mechanism, this methodology of helping people be heard through polling, through survey research. And after 9/11, our CEO, Jim Clifton, just looked around and realized that no one really knew what was on the minds of a billion Muslims. He was watching a press conference where Donald Rumsfeld was asked, "How do Muslims feel about these attacks?" And he said, Donald Rumsfeld's response was, "Well, I don't know. It's not like you can take a Gallup poll." And it was sort of that that sparked this need to really take that mission that Gallup started 7 years ago to the entire world, because no time was it more important to help people be heard, to actually get the views of ordinary people to leaders than now, when there was so much confusion and misunderstanding.
That's very true. And, you know, you collaborated with John Esposito. How did that come about? Was it, did you find that it was more of a dynamic collaboration because of your two varied backgrounds?
Well, collaborating with John Esposito was really something I could hardly believe was happening. It was really a dream of mine to get to work with him. And basically, I just wrote him an email and asked him and told him about our project and asked him if he'd like to be our senior scientist, our lead advisor on the project, and then asked him to come over and meet our CEO. And
right.
He did. He was interested. He thought the project sounded interesting and thought, you know, he could spend a few minutes with us here at Gallup. And so he came and ended up staying a lot longer than he anticipated because of what he heard. That was the first time I ever met him, and he also met Jim Clifton, our CEO, and we talked about the project. And what I think really attracted him is, for once, we were going to move beyond the battle of the experts and get to the real hard data on what Muslims really believe,
right.
Rather than just guessing. And just the breadth of the scope and the breadth of the project, the number of countries, the length of time we wanted to keep doing it. So we've pledged to keep studying all of this for the next 100 years. He was just so blown away by it and decided to join the project. And it's been, you know, it was just wonderful working with him, because what you might expect is someone with his experience and his name and expertise and status, and working with someone who's relatively young and new to the field or new definitely to this, you know, arena on sort of a national or global platform, that we might have a relationship of sort of a very unequal relationship of sort of him dominating the conversations and dictating what we do, and that wasn't the case at all. We were really equal partners in our collaboration. I never felt that my opinions weren't being heard or that I had to go along with something I wasn't comfortable with. So it was just a wonderful and very enjoyable partnership. And I would actually also add Jean Esposito, his wife, to that. I think we were really a team of three.
Well, that's just by listening to that, it's like it was a very prolific study. So you mentioned like the number of countries you went to and the time it took. Do you feel that the goals you set out to achieve this project, you sort of accomplished them? And in the sense that, like, the data that was collected and the findings that were published in your book, have you seen that they've affected the way maybe American companies and institutions are taking their viewpoint?
I really do, and I think the real impact of giving ordinary people a voice and having Muslims actually speak for themselves, I think the real impact of that we'll never be able to fully measure. I think there's so much that that is happening that we don't know about. But we have seen an enormous amount of evidence that getting this information out is having positive impact. We've talked to Hollywood producers who have said that that reading the book has really transformed their thinking on Muslims, and that they really feel like they want to contribute to better understanding through their own work. One person who said that is Howard Gordon, who is the executive producer of 24. Who read the book and was very complimentary and really said that it really helped him understand and he said that he, you know, the data in it that said that Americans when asked what they admire most about the Muslim world, and the most frequent response was nothing and I don't know. He said, you know, what am I doing to help correct this problem? You know, that's one example, but there are many more, and I think it's something that I think will take time to really see the full impact. But I'm very optimistic because we've just gotten a tremendous response to the book from people from every walk of life, from the full political spectrum. People, you know, you might not expect, but have really appreciated the idea of doing more of an evidence-based study rather than just a war of opinions.
That's interesting you say that because, as you said before, like it's the book seeks to find a balance between two extremist viewpoints. Muslims hating the West or the West hating Muslims. And would you say that your book was something of an answer to the clash of civilizations, that whole ideology and concept?
Well, I think what the book did is to test the clash of civilizations with empirical data. And when we look at some of the basic assumptions of the clash of civilizations, we find that they really are crushed under the weight of empirical evidence. The idea that Muslims are inherently opposed to the West because of a clash in cultures and values. We found that that's not the case at all. Muslims don't hate democracy. They admire the West for it. That the West itself has a unique and universal values that everyone shares. And there, that's not even entirely true. There isn't a monolithic West, and there isn't a monolithic Muslim world. So it was just really looking at the root or the base assumptions of the Clash of Civilizations thesis in light of data, in light of evidence, and finding that much of it just didn't hold up.
Yeah, that's very true, especially since you say that in the book, that how Muslims look favorably upon some of the Western social democratic institutions. And do you think that in Muslim countries, or possibly as we as Muslim Ummah, are on the verge of kind of fusing that Western democracy with Sharia? And is that possible? Could it be achieved in our lifetime?
I think that's a really interesting question. I would say that many people do certainly favor a model of governance that would combine values of representative democracy and fuse them with the principles of faith. Now, whether that is the same as fusing Western democracy and Sharia, I'm not sure. But we do know that when we look at the data, what people really, the kind of democracy or the kind of government that they would want if it were up to them, would be one that would guarantee basic freedoms of speech, religion, of assembly, and at the same time be informed by the principles of Sharia. Some would say that those basic democratic values are already inherently a part of Sharia, and it really isn't the infusion of a Western model with Sharia, but rather the full manifestation of Sharia, you know, as it stands within the tradition.
Right. It's interesting because you have so many Western criticisms towards Islamic styles of government, but it's more of a political thing, I find personally. When you have corrupt governments in the Middle East, and it's not really a reflection of Sharia at all, or Islamic governance. So perhaps it's not even a fusion; it's just getting back to our core Islamic values, and we find that our values are very similar to those of the Western world. But as you were saying before, there's a significant proportion of people, as it says in your book, page 45, that there's a Washington Post ABC poll that shows that nearly half Americans look at Islam unfavorably. There's a very negative conceptions of Muslims. Is there anything we can do as young people, and just people participating in day-to-day life, to change that? How can we, as young American Muslims, work to change this?
Well, one of the strongest factors that actually determines or predicts whether or not someone will have prejudice or whether or not someone will have an unfavorable view of Muslim of Islam is whether or not they know a Muslim. And if they know a Muslim, they're more likely to have a positive view of Islam and Muslims. So I think it's really through engagement. It's through working with people, just giving Muslims a familiar human face by engaging and working with people in the greater community on common goals and interests. And it's only going to be through that long-term process that this problem will be reversed, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we talk about the average Muslim, and in your book you have the words average Muslim. How would you define an average Muslim? And does that mean that obviously is different from when you go to East to West and average Muslim in North America or the average Muslim in, say, Syria? But how do you think that applies to us living in North America?
Well, I think, the term average Muslim is really more of an expression, meaning a person who is not not particularly famous, not particularly exceptional in their, not particularly unique in their views, in their beliefs, and is looks and not but thinks, believes as the majority do, and that person in many cases is not represented in the public space when it comes to Muslims, that that people are speaking for them. And you're absolutely right that what that person would be like is very different whether they're in, if we're talking about someone in Syria versus someone in North America. But even when we just talk about Muslims in North America, the majority view, the mainstream view, is not heard as often as is an extreme view, whether it's an extreme view that's telling people what they want to hear, or is saying, or it's sort of conforming to a stereotype of violence.
Mm-hmm. I sort of, for me, just being a Muslim myself, I see the Muslim community as sort of, I mean, I wouldn't say we're boring, but we don't have that sort of element of the way that's portrayed in the media, where you have these extremist people living very fast, dangerous lives. The majority of Muslims, in my opinion, I think, were just very kind of average Joe. But just
yeah.
With a slightly different way of life. And I think one of the reasons why there's been so many misconceptions and misperceptions of Muslims is because we sort of, the immigrant community, sort of isolate themselves and just go about their business and don't really seek to share as much. So do you think that's a sort of a positive thing we can take out of all of this, the negative media attention, make us come out of our shells and share Islam with people and make it less of a extremist or alien thing to people?
No, I think absolutely. It is something that we've just, as Muslims in America, have no choice. It's not even an option to stay isolated or to decide to be isolated. I think Muslims have been engaged in civic engagement for a very long time, so I don't think it's completely a new thing. Now, this certainly should increase, but it's just not even something we have the luxury to think about or to decide either way. It really it's a must. We have to engage and come out of that shell and let people know who we really are.
And especially now with the elections coming up, and there's so much publicity about that, you don't really find much talk directed towards the Muslim community. It's almost as if we just kind of politely step over us. So it's not to sort of offend anybody, but we do sort of see that there's no specific campaigns or specific attempts to sort of court the Muslim public. Do you think there's a civic responsibility, which is really important for us as Western Muslims, to sort of make our voices be heard?
I definitely do, because, you know, ultimately our fate is really in our hands, and we just simply can't wait for anyone else to do anything for us. We have to really take things and make sure that our voices are heard. That's what many groups that have come before us have done, and now it's really our turn to help America grow by including us as we are.
And I think that's a very important message to the young people out there too, because I mean they're the ones getting introduced to the voting process. But just moving on, you mentioned there are core grievances in the Muslim world in your book, and maybe that's the factor towards why Muslim people have become sort of apathetic towards politics. But that's the sort of a key understanding of what's going on in the Muslim world. So what are these core grievances, according to you?
I think the core grievances that we have uncovered in our research are essentially can be categorized into three levels or three categories. One is Muslims believe that they are disrespected and they and their religion are seen as inferior and looked down upon by the West. Second, that they are is the issue of political domination. And people in majority Muslim countries, many of them believe that the United States dominates their countries politically and is standing in the way of their self-determination. They don't believe that the U.S. is serious about democracy in their countries. And then finally, the third is the issue of acute conflicts, meaning the conflict in the in Iraq and Afghanistan and between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So those three issues are what combine to really create the core grievances that Muslims cite as causing tensions between them and the United States. Now, it's important to also note that they don't think that they are blameless. They also tell us that what they need to do to improve relations with the West is to help control extremism, fanaticism, and to modernize and improve the presentation of Islam.
So Muslims feel that there is a way we can move on from these core grievances, not ignoring them, but just sort of not being at a standstill?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we found that the majority of Muslims and the majority of the American public believe that greater interaction between the Muslim world and the West is more a benefit than a threat. So despite all the tensions and misunderstandings, people all over the world are eager for greater interaction and want to reach out.
So with that sort of the majority opinion of the Muslim public. However, you have these extremist fringe groups, and as you said in your book and you mentioned before, they're the product of political ideologies. So with this political sort of backdrop, they ignore the balance and the ethics of Islam, and they're just sort of in this quest for power. What role did modernity and such political ideologies play in contributing to the recent rise of these extremist sort of ideologies and mentalities in recent decades?
Well, I think that, you know, they are definitely a product of modernity, I say that because many people talk about them and in terms of being medieval or adhering to medieval principles or medieval ideas, which really could not be further from the truth. There's nothing medieval about them. They're extremely modern. They're coming up with modern interpretations of what is allowed in war. They're coming up with modern, never seen before ideas of what is allowed in terms of tactics for creating change. And they are very much products of revisionist interpretations that are new and not a continuation of tradition.
People sort of see the Islamic aspect of it, and they, as you said, they turn it into some medieval, pre-civilization or pre-postmodern type of backward thinking. But in reality, I think there's a lot of parallels between, Muslim extremists and, a lot of, the IRA or the fascists. And even the conflict that's going on in India and that sort of thing. So would you say that there are parallels like that? And maybe it's just a media spin that's making people focus more on the Islamic aspect?
I definitely think there are parallels. And in fact, they really fit almost perfectly the classic profile for violent revolutionary terrorists. And what violent revolutionary terrorists look like are that they want change, they want And they speak about grievances that are popular and resonate with a lot of people, but they usually envision change that is much more radical and fast than the majority desires. So they're speaking about grievances that are shared with others, but they are always more extreme than the majority. They also speak in the language of the dominant ideology of their community. So, whatever that is, Marxist revolutionaries will speak in terms of Marxism, and when their most prominent ideology is Islam, then those radicals will always speak in that language and use those symbols. Just like the Ku Klux Klan used Christian symbolism when they were prominent in the American South, because Christianity was such a prominent part of the society. And so revolutionaries, wherever they are, want to create change, feel that violence is the only viable option, and use rhetoric and symbols that resonate and reflect the dominant social medium of their societies.
And that's very interesting that you're saying this, the quick change, the violent change. That's sort of, in my understanding, is that going against what Islam traditionally advocates in terms of government? Isn't that sort of the move away from traditional Islam in terms of how you
Well, it
view
definitely
yourself?
is. In fact, that's been the way that de-radicalization has occurred in Saudi Arabia and Yemen, is to re-educate youth who have been radicalized into militant groups. And the way to reverse that, the way that it has worked in terms of the people getting that process being reversed, the only thing that in fact has ever worked has been a re-education. In Islamic tradition, in the orthodoxy of the faith. And it really shows that perhaps Islam is the only thing powerful enough to combat bin Ladenism.
Exactly. It's sort of the contention that it's not because of Islam we're having these problems, it's because of an absence of proper Islamic knowledge. And this kind of came up in a video that the site posted of a discussion between you and Irshad Mandi, where you were arguing against free for all ijtihad. That video actually generated over 1,500 hits on our website in 3 days. And that's actually a really empowering and overwhelming sense of how Muslims were responding to that, and it was really nice to see. Do you see it yourself as a role model for young Muslims, especially young Muslim sisters?
I don't think of myself as a role model, actually. I do think of myself as someone who's been given an opportunity to speak and therefore have a profound responsibility to do so well. And I'm really happy, it pleases me very much that people felt that video was empowering. I think one thing that we have to really be aware of as we work with young people is that the same media that has that, according to media content analysis, shows that the majority of Muslim protagonists are militants, and that the majority of statements made about Islam are negative. That same media that has caused the majority of Americans to actually admit to having at least some prejudice against Muslims, it's the same media that young Muslims also consume, and there is an effect that it has on them. They're not immune to it. It's that same media that portrays Muslims so negatively is also having an effect on young Muslims, and it's affecting, I think, the way they view themselves, the way they interact with other people, the way they have relationships, their family. And we really have to be very aware of this and try to address this deep psychological problem that I think is just going to increase. I think Muslims, young Muslims, have problems of depression. They have issues around bullying. There's so much going on with them that I don't think is being addressed or thought about. And so if a video made them, you know, made some people feel empowered, I think that's wonderful. And I, alhamdulillah, that that happened. But it's just such a big problem that I think religious leaders and community leaders need to address.
Do you think that in part it could be solved by getting more involved in the media or sort of owning and producing portions of the media ourselves? Do you think that could be positive, a positive contribution?
Absolutely. I think that would be an enormously positive contribution, and I encourage young people to really consider careers in art and culture. And in addition to that, to also consider careers in writing, in producing.
Sort of non-traditional things.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those kinds of skills have to really be fostered in the community.
Just lastly, one more reference to that video where you responded to Manji's contention regarding ijtihad by saying that, as I said before, the irresponsible ijtihad gave us Al Qaeda, and at the same time you made a number of references to the ijazah system, Dr. Ali Guma and Al Azhar, and other sort of normative sources of knowledge that fall more under the traditional threads of Islam. Could you comment on that Al-Qaeda statement as well as the role of the tradition in keeping this balance?
Well, I mean, what we find in our research is that when we ask people who have condemned terrorism why they condemn it, they tell us it's because they have a moral objection to terrorism, and much of the time that moral objection is rooted in religion. But when we ask them why they condone it, those who say that it was justified, their response is rooted in issues of revenge and revolution and not religion. And so when we take a step back and understand how Muslims, the majority of Muslims, actually understand their faith, it is in direct opposition to Bin Laden's ideology, and it's a break from tradition, and it's a break from scholarly ijtihad.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bin Laden's approach in his justification for his actions is an ijtihad of ignorance, is an ijtihad of non-specialists, is sort of a freelance vigilante ijtihad, and it's really the same approach that Irshad is advocating, which is that everyone is just as qualified as anyone else to reinterpret the faith, and if you know that if you don't like something, I mean both groups, both of those approaches have essentially one thing in common, and it is that when they find in Islam's ethical code a limit on the actions they would like to take, they do away with those limits through the magic wand of an ijtihad of ignorance. You know, I don't like this limit on my actions. This is what I want to do. And so, therefore, I will reinterpret away the prohibition. And this is what Bin Laden's done when asked, in an interview in November 2001, how can you justify your actions in light of Islamic teachings? He concedes that women and children should not be killed in war, and that's what the Prophet said, but that in modern times, because of the new situation that we face, that this is no longer the case. So he is exercising a modern interpretation. He is not using anything traditional, and that same approach of just wishing away the ethical restraints on our actions is what, you know, this other approach that I was arguing against seems to also be. calling for.
It's really interesting to see how actually very similar the two lines of thinking are. They appear so different, but they're actually quite similar. Do you think there's anything we can do in North America to kind of bring this traditional Islam into the mainstream and make it more familiar to people?
Well, I think it's very, very important. This idea of religious literacy is just absolutely vital. And Muslims are the first people who need greater religious literacy so that they aren't, so that young people are not subject to being exploited by extremists in either direction. And they know what their faith is, and they can be critical in their consumption of opinions. We really need to foster this critical religious literacy as a way to combat extremism of all kinds.
And just to finish up this interview, are there any future projects you're planning? If you wouldn't hear.
Well, our future project that we're working on is a poll of American Muslims, and we hope to have that out in early November, inshallah.
That sounds really interesting, inshallah. I'm sure everybody will be keeping an eye on that. Thank you very, very much for doing this interview with us.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dalia. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Please visit SohaibWeb.com for other exclusive audio and articles.